listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, there's been a rise in demand for meat from small farmers and butchers here in Wisconsin. We'll find out why and what to know if we're interested in making our first purchase from a local producer. First, we've received several questions on the next topic from listeners, including Judy Olson from Bailey's Harbor and Emily Brookheiser from Madison. Here's Emily with her question.
Where does the word "wah" in a lot of Wisconsin city names come from? For example, Wausau, Waukesha, and Wanakee all start with "wah," and I'm wondering what language that comes from and what it means.
To go about answering this question, we called up a couple of experts. Monica McCauley is a professor of language sciences at UW-Madison and affiliated faculty with the university's American Indian Studies program. She works with the Menominee and their language revitalization and reclamation programs. Monica, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
And Brian McInnes is an associate professor of civil society and community studies in the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. Brian's a native Ojibwe speaker, enrolled member of the Ojibwe Nation, and a descendant of the Wisconsin Potawatomi tribe. Brian, welcome to the show. Do we have you, Brian? Well, we'll try to get him, but
yeah,
Monica, oh, there you are.
I made it. I'm here. Thank you so much.
Wonderful.
For welcoming.
I think we lost you there for just a sec. Well, I wanted to ask each of you, before we get into this question of the WA part of names, I wanted to ask each of you about work that you're doing with native language preservation and revitalization. Brian, can you tell us a little bit about what you're working on?
Sure. And one of the things that I'm really pleased and excited about is I will be taking over the Ojibwe language program at the University of Wisconsin-Madison this coming fall. So that's something I greatly look forward to, and that's also very complementary to my work in language immersion education, as well as storytelling traditions in northern Wisconsin communities.
And Monica, same question. What kind of work are you doing?
I'd say the most exciting work that I'm doing is working with the Menominee. They've started a new immersion daycare, and for the first time in a very long time, you've got little tiny babies learning to speak Menominee as their first language, so that's very exciting.
Now, for a little background before we dig into the question at hand, Brian, can you tell us a little bit about the variety of native languages that have been and currently are spoken in the Wisconsin area?
Yeah, Wisconsin is, you know, a very exciting state in terms of its linguistic diversity. You know, we have in northern parts of the state, we certainly have Ojibwe widely spoken, but also, as Monica has indicated, Menominee, one of our cousin languages, Potawatomi or Bodewadmi is also a very dynamic and important language in our state. But then we also have languages from other indigenous nations, such as, you know, the Ho-Chunk people. And of course, in Madison, Wisconsin, we're very respectful of the Ho-Chunk and their traditional territory here. We have Oneida language, which is also a very significant and historic language in Wisconsin. So we're quite fortunate to have that kind of dynamic vibrancy in our state.
And Monica, Brian mentioned a couple of the languages on that list were cousins. I understand some of them are very far separated. I've seen people say, yeah, some of them are as closely related as German and Chinese, for example.
Well, Menominee, Potawatomi, and Ojibwe are all from the same language family. So it would be like being an Indo-European language or something like that. Ho-Chunk is Siouan, and Oneida is Iroquoian, and they are completely unrelated families.
All right, now let's get to the question that started us off here, this wah syllable that appears from Milwaukee to Wauwatosa to Wausau and beyond. And I understand the answer isn't as simple as I might have thought it would have been. Where do you want to start on this, Brian?
Sure. You know, it's one of the things with, I think, when you think of the location of where these places are and then think of the traditional groups of Native people who would have occupied each of those locations. And in so many cases, I think, as Monica was indicating, you know, we do have Algonquin-speaking peoples who were in a number of those areas. So, but again, it becomes the challenge of, I think, every place name researcher to try to figure out what might have gone awry in the way the name was first written down. And as importantly, the way the name gets said today. So that's usually an interesting starting place when we're trying to determine what was the original place name and what was the meaning behind that place name. Does that sound right, Monica?
That totally sounds right. I've been spending my day, it was really a lot of fun, because I'm a big word nerd, and I've been spending my name looking at this wonderful book by Virgil Vogel called Indian Names on Wisconsin's Map. And he did a lot of the work for us. And basically the answer to the question is, nope, there's no relationship. The Wa, it's just chance that they start with Wa.
Interesting. Yeah. And is part of that, Monica, the translation issue, maybe there were a bunch of different words, maybe in different languages that, say, English settlers or maybe French settlers, depending on the timing, kind of all heard and lumped together as that Wa syllable?
No, in each case, there's a pretty clear etymology for it. So Wasaw, for example, comes from the Ojibwe word for far away or distant. Brian, how would you say that yourself?
I would say Wasa.
Wasa, yeah. So that's probably what it comes from. And then Wanakee, now this one I don't know, and Brian, you can tell me if this makes any sense to you. What Vogel says is that he says it's possibly from Wanakee, I inhabit a place in peace.
And that is, you know, I think that's one of the interesting things when we're working at reconstructing a meaning in a word from some map by someone's, I guess, iteration or version of that. I would agree that could be a meaning of it. It could also be a place where somebody got lost, too. So
oh, really?
That is also a possibility, Wanakee, you know, getting lost on one's journey upon the earth. So who knows? But that's also times when you have the place name without the story to go with it. It's sometimes hard to contextualize what the person actually meant to say.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Brian, any other names? We've got a lot of cities with that Wa syllable. Any others that stand out to you as you know, possible sources of their meanings?
Sure. And, you know, one of the things I think, especially when you drive through the greater, you know, Milwaukee area, the place names there, you really see the richness of especially the Potawatomi historic influence there. And so when you're, you know, and like as Monica said, a word nerd, or like I'm very much that myself, you know, trying to read through wondering what does that actually mean? What is the, so it actually becomes a little dangerous driving through there sometimes because there's so many fantastic words. But, you know, when you figure one out, there's this incredibly, you feel like you've just done something amazing, like you just figured out this puzzle. And a lot of times in Algonquin languages in particular, you know, the Wa can refer to, you know, flashes of light or brightness. And so when you hear the Wa Watosa, and it makes you think of, you know, the old Potawatomi word for firefly, and that kind of, especially with the reduplicated, the double Wa, it refers to something which might be flashing or intermittent in its frequency. So it's something, you know, bright and some kind of light, or, you know, beautiful effervescence coming off something. So it's actually, for a place name to have that meaning or association, it would be a very positive kind of meaning. So that's usually most welcome.
Well, that's really interesting. So it's, you know, in my head, I thought it would be a Wa would be like water or place or something like this one word. But it sounds like, Monica, not only is it not that, it also, there might be layers of symbolism or metaphor built up in these names as well.
Mm-hmm. But sometimes it might be very simple. So the book that I was looking at, Vogel, didn't have an explanation for Waukesha. And I looked around on the web, and it looks like it probably comes from the Potawatomi word for fox. And I'm not sure I can pronounce this right, but it's something like Wakshe. What is it in Ojibwe, Brian?
Would be Wagush.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
That's in the ballpark. Okay, so that might be a case, do you think, Brian, where it was named after a particular word?
Oh, very much so. And, you know, so many places may also, you know, derive their meaning from, you know, the historic shared tribal or indigenous legacy of the state. You know, we know for, you know, hundreds of years, different tribal groups have made Wisconsin their home or been through Wisconsin. And, you know, even the legacy of their presence and their history in the state may be reflected in some of these place names. I often think of Madison, you know, our wonderful four lakes here. You know, when you think of Wingra, you know, place of many ducks, the Ho-Chunk name, and you think of, you know, like Monona, which, you know, has been rumored to be an Algonquin name, but, you know, we really had to think about that before we finally, you know, were able to derive Minonaguet, a lake of beautiful appearing water, to even Mendota, which might be derived from a Dakota name. So I think these place names, they refer as much to, you know, the present contemporary uses of these places or ways that we know them to the historic occupations of tribal groups.
Well, in a way, I want to, you know, get a time machine and go back and learn the stories. But in a way, and here's where I want to wrap up, I want to ask both of you about the value of talking about these languages in the present tense as living languages now. Brian, let's start with you.
I think it's especially in the present when language revitalization is so important to all Indigenous peoples in Minnesota that, you know, learning Indigenous languages, promoting Indigenous languages, you know, really there could be nothing more quintessentially American than that. That is our original shared history and one that we can all be proud of and can all learn and celebrate together.
And Monica, your thoughts on the present day, present and future of Native languages?
I think one of the most moving things I ever heard was at a meeting where a young woman whose language had not been spoken for a while, but who was working towards bringing it back, said that when she heard the word extinct, it made her feel horrible. And she sort of stood there and then she just said, "I am not extinct." And it's so much to do with identity. It's an incredibly important piece of people's identity, and that's why it's really important to keep them going.
We'll leave it there for now. Monica, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Brian, thanks for being with us.
Miigwech. Thank you.
We've been talking to Monica McCauley, Professor of Language Sciences at UW-Madison, and Brian McInnes, Associate Professor of Civil Society and Community Studies, also at UW-Madison. We talked to them today about the roots of Wisconsin place names that have WAU, W-A-U, in them, and what they tell us about language past and present. And this conversation came from several audience questions as part of our Why Wisconsin project. Submit your own questions, and we might answer it in a future story. Go to WPR.org/WhySconsin. That's Wisconsin, spelled with W-H-Y, not W-A-U. Coming up, we'll find out why the demand for meat from small farmers and processors is up during the COVID-19 pandemic. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, things like music festivals and large work conferences had been a growing part of American life, but the coronavirus has basically put a halt to them. We'll talk about the impact that has on the experience economy. First, the COVID-19 pandemic has shaken up a lot of aspects of the economy, including the supply chain for the meat industry. While big meat packing plants have been ordered to stay open, some consumers are starting to look elsewhere for their meat. Small farmers and meat processors in Wisconsin are reporting a spike in demand for their products. For some customers, it might be their first time buying meat from a smaller local source. Jeff Sindelar is an associate professor and extension meat specialist in the Department of Animal and Dairy Sciences in the College of Agriculture and Life Science at UW-Madison. Jeff, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Great to be back.
Well, how big an impact has the pandemic had on the meat supply chain?
Well, I think most could agree or understand that it has had a pretty large impact, right? I mean, we're talking about terms and words like meat crises, and, you know, I've really been referring to them more as meat shortages, but anytime that a crisis is linked with an industry, we know that definitely there's been an impact and lots of things that have been happening and creating this, you know, impact.
Now, in the meat industry, we hear again and again, you name the meat and it's dominated by, you know, a number of producers that you can count on one hand, 3-4 producers. But under the radar there, we have these smaller producers. How many of them, how big a deal is this in a place like Wisconsin?
Yeah, so absolutely. I mean, the meat industry is very dynamic and very unique. And we have, you know, very large, you know, meat processing establishments that might have 3,000 or more employees, down to very small operations, you know, small establishments that might have a handful, you know, 10 or less. And they're sprinkled throughout the state of Wisconsin and across the country. And in Wisconsin, we have about 400, 425 licensed meat and poultry processing establishments. And probably about 90% of those are small and very small plants, family-run businesses that have 30, 35 employees or less.
Have we seen a rise in consumer demand now? I mean, I've seen some reports about this. Are you seeing this rise in consumer demand for smaller producers and processors?
Most certainly. And this has been kind of going rampant over the past several weeks. And it really started with the closing of some of the very large plants, as well as slowing down the production, which has created this chain reaction. And, you know, us as consumers have witnessed less products in the grocery stores, in some cases none, and definitely some high variability and volatility of prices that we're seeing in stores. So this is all attributed to, right, lots and lots of people looking at other places to find their meat products, and small and very small meat processors in the state have absolutely been a target and have responded to those needs.
That's the demand side. Now, how about the supply side, where we've seen stories of, you know, people who are raising, you know, pigs, beef cattle, chickens, whatever, all of a sudden that plant shuts down for a while because of an outbreak there. Are they trying to look to these smaller processors to have a place to sell their livestock?
Absolutely. There's been a concerted effort throughout the state of Wisconsin, that's to try to find places to go with some of these animals, and you know, that is really the tragedy of this entire situation, in my opinion. Right, we raise animals for food, and you know, we have animals as pets, but the animals for food, if we do not utilize those animals for the purpose in which they exist, it really is a disservice. You know, it's a waste, right? So there's been huge efforts in all counts and all in a whole bunch of different ways, all stemming from the university to the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection to trade association groups such as the Wisconsin Pork Association, the Wisconsin Beef Council, and the Wisconsin Beef Cattle Associations, and others, to try to figure out how can they get these animals, you know, not make it a tragedy, but try to get some of these more of these animals processed in the small and very small establishments. Have been doing all that they can to help, and so definitely they have been front and center, not a solution, but have supported the unfortunate situation that has occurred in the state of Wisconsin.
We're talking about a growing demand for meat produced by smaller producers and processors here in Wisconsin. Jeff Sindelar is with us, associate professor and extension meat specialist at UW-Madison. Jeff, if there's somebody out there thinking, yeah, this sounds good, but I know where to find meat in my grocery store, I don't know where how to find this stuff from smaller processors, but where do they start? What do they need to know?
Sure. So there's a lot of them sprinkled across the state of Wisconsin. There's one county in the state of Wisconsin that does not have a small meat processor. And of course, you know, nearly all of them have more than one, and some have many. So you can obviously, you know, contact a local chamber of commerce, you know, or someone in a you know, the county seat, for example, and ask them. You can go to a couple of websites, right? So you can go to the Wisconsin Association of Meat Processors, and that website is wi-amp.com. They list a couple hundred small, very small meat processors across the state. You can go to the Wisconsin Department of Ag and Trade and Consumer Protection, something special from Wisconsin website. They have a meat section and they list a bunch of those. And sometimes it's just asking a neighbor or a friend.
How about safety? Do these smaller producers have comparable safety and inspection guidelines as the larger ones would?
Yeah, absolutely. So in the state of Wisconsin, we have meat processing establishments that operate under federal inspection. So the federal government serves as the inspectors, federal employees. We're one of 27 states in Wisconsin because of the size of our industry that has a state meat inspection program. So the state of Wisconsin has inspectors that go into the plants. Irregardless, they all follow federal regulations for food safety, for labeling, for truthful and accuracy of, you know, weights and measurements and what's on the label and ingredients and so forth. So the products from small, very small plants is equally safe as those that you would find from some of your, you know, more mainstream plants and companies.
I know some of these you can buy, you know, what you need to grill this weekend, say, but some of them you might be able to buy a quarter or a half a cow. What do we need to do to be prepared to store those larger purchases?
Yeah, so if you have an opportunity, and many of us already do this through direct marketing, and many of us also do this through what's called custom processing, right? So just a few weeks ago, I had a beef animal. I was a half owner in a beef animal. I had that harvested at Country Meat Cutters just outside Madison. I gave them an order. I said, this is how we'd like it packaged, the thickness of the cuts, the amount of product in each cuts. And then of course, they contacted me and told me when that it was ready to be picked up. So what consumers have to be aware of is, right, it's usually a lot of product. So like a half a beef, for example, you're talking about, you know, nearly 200 pounds of meat that you have to do something with. And so, you know, once you're able to find a place for it, a home for it, storing it properly in a really good freezer where you're maintaining, you know, really good cold temperatures is very, very critical.
We have a question I'm going to pass along from Brad. If you can answer it just briefly, we've got deer processors in the state. They're not too busy right now with deer. Can we convert them to help produce that excess supply that might be coming from producers here?
Yeah, that's a super great question. It's a very creative question. So potentially yes, but also potentially no. So deer processors generally do not have to follow state or federal regulations, which are the same as used for beef, pork, lamb, poultry, and so forth. And so they would have to apply for inspection for that type of for harvesting or processing these types of animals. But as long as they have the equipment, and as long as they state, as long as they pass standards for the, showing that they can safely produce food in those plants, they absolutely could. That would absolutely be an option.
And we'll have to leave it at that. Thanks to our guest, Jeff Sindelar, Associate Professor and Extension Meat Specialist at UW-Madison, talking about a rise in demand for small meat producers. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at 8:30 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at the Veterans Administration health system and how it's coping with the impact of the pandemic. That's Monday at 8:30 on The Morning Show. Now, seeing live music and going to a work conference might seem like two very different things, but one author says they're both part of something called the experience economy, the business of gathering people to do stuff together. Our next guest says the in-person event sector was responsible for a growing share of the U.S. economy, and with the massive disruption during the coronavirus outbreak, it's facing some big questions about its future. David Gellis writes the Corner Office column, along with other features for the New York Times Sunday Business section. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, give us a sense of the range of what we're talking about when we talk about this experience economy.
Just think about what we're missing right now. Baseball games, Chuck E. Cheese, concerts. It's all the business of bringing people together. And all of these events, obviously, are on hold right now. And the truth is, a lot of them are going to be on hold for quite some time, even as some other things start to come back.
Pre-pandemic, how big a deal was this part of our economy?
It was big and getting bigger all the time. And that was for a few reasons. On the one hand, there's just a robust business to be done in the business of getting people together. We saw things like pop-up experiences coming together. We saw axe throwing bars and all sorts of new ways to get people out and about and with their friends. And obviously, this is how people spend money. Just look at the boom in live sports. That was driven in part by our innate love of sports, but also by the fact that sports, and especially live sports, are very lucrative. So we saw this huge boom in college sports, as well as new leagues like Major League Soccer and the WNBA come up in recent years. And this was all happening as other parts of the economy that had traditionally been very robust, think manufacturing in the United States, gradually waned. So the experience economy was large, and it kept getting bigger.
Yeah, and I see over the years, you know, finance experts and happiness experts keep saying, hey, the best way to spend your money isn't on the stuff, it's on the experiences. Obviously, we Americans were still buying stuff, but it seems like the experiences were becoming a more and more important part of our daily lives, our business lives, and more.
That's because doing things together and being out with the people we love, it's not just a fun diversion. It's not just good for the economy. It's how we make meaning. It's how we create identity. And when you go to a Grateful Dead concert or a Fish concert, you're not just hearing live music. It's a way to associate yourself. It's a way to identify yourself and find your community.
And let's talk about now the jobs impact of the coronavirus shutdown. A lot of sectors hit hard here. How much of the job loss we see, though, is in some aspect of this experience economy?
A huge portion of the more than 38 million jobs that have been lost over the last many weeks are directly tied to this part of the economy. And that's unfortunately for obvious reasons. You know, when you think about all the people that should be out at the ballparks right now, selling beers and hawking peanuts and, checking your tickets and working the parking lots, they're obviously not just there. And that is just repeated ad nauseum at swimming pools, at laser tag parks, and at baseball parks all around the country.
David Gellis is with us. He writes the Corner Office column, along with other features, at the New York Times Sunday Business section. He wrote a recent piece on the hit that this experience economy is taking during the coronavirus pandemic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you work in a job along these lines or own a business? And if you are thinking about, well, when do I get back to do stuff like this, go to the theater, the water park, the axe-throwing bar, the normal kind of bar for that matter, are you ready to do it now? When are you going to be ready to do it if not? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And, David, that's one piece of the puzzle you looked at in your piece. You know, the idea that, okay, when the official orders shutting these things down, and are people going to come back? What kind of signs are we seeing?
It's obviously going to be mixed depending on the region of the country and depending really on consumers' willingness and businesses' willingness to, let's be real, take some amount of risk. I was just before we got on this phone on a call with the guy who reports on the theater, the Broadway business in New York City for us at the New York Times, and we were comparing notes. And he said, listen, even if New York City schools open in September, which is something we're all watching closely, I've got school-age kids, I hope they're going to school in September, what's the likelihood that the Broadway shows are also going to be open in September? Well, I'd guess that it's a long shot. So I think these events are going to be among the last ones to come back, unfortunately, especially in big cities and especially when you think about these big events, which is why so many of the major professional sports leagues are making plans. We've seen very detailed plans in some of the leagues to play games without fans in the stands, which, again, just seems crazy. And as recently as a couple months ago, LeBron James was saying he wouldn't do it. I think we're all now coming to a place where we realize this may be a part of our lives. And we may see the experience economy come back in stages where the experience is happening and you might be able to watch that experience on stage, but you can't actually be there for it in person.
Speaking of big events, you talked to an organizer with South by Southwest, the huge music festival that's turned into a festival for lots of things other than music as well. A lot of people build their year around this event, I think. What kind of things did you hear?
So I actually had an extended conversation with him a few weeks ago, and he was in such a difficult place. South by Southwest was supposed to get going, you know, full steam ahead with, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of people come to Austin, Texas for this festival. It's a week of film, a week of music, and a week of technology, thousands of vendors, hundreds of millions of dollars into the local economy. And they were literally at the stage where the trucks were at the convention center setting up the booths, right? Like, this thing was about ready to go. And he was in this tricky place because this was right in mid-March, the week everything sort of changed on the country. And he was being pressured by all sides to make the decision himself, right? Everyone was starting to realize this thing probably just isn't safe to have. And so they were calling on South By to make the decision itself. But he was in a position where he felt he actually couldn't do that. The economic consequences of doing that were so profound that he essentially said, we need cover from the local government. And so he said, listen, it's up to the city of Austin. He needed the mayor, ultimately, to make that decision. And when the mayor finally did, that's when it all got shut down. But again, the implications are profound. This is hundreds of thousands of people that weren't coming to Austin. All those hundreds of thousands of Airbnbs and hotels rooms went empty. All those hundreds of thousands of restaurant reservations evaporated. And as a consequence, you're talking about tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars of economic activity that just disappeared overnight. And this is what's lost from an economic perspective when we can't get together.
Can you talk about the impact that can have on a community? I mean, there are some places smaller than Austin that have maybe, you know, a bunch of water slide parks or other tourist amenities, things like that, that really count on this one kind of industry, this kind of experience economy industry for the local economy. This is going to hit more than just the businesses themselves, isn't it?
Without a doubt. And I think we're a real test, and you're right to point it out, is sort of these summer communities. I'm up here in New Hampshire, where I've been for the last few months. And it was very interesting. I had to get out of the house and make a little errand today. And as I did that, I saw hundreds, if not thousands of cars coming up the interstate from Boston, clearly coming up for the Memorial Day weekend. So it's going to be fascinating to see when people are out and about, and we're all starting to get out and about more than we were, say, a month or two ago, to what extent they patronize the water parks here, the small amusement parks up here in rural New Hampshire, for example. Some of them, frankly, are just not open yet. And so when they have the all clear to open, they may go ahead. But even then, are people going to show up? I quoted one guy in the story who opened his, we've said it a few times now, his axe throwing bar in Atlanta. And unfortunately, you know, they stayed open all week and he had two customers. And so that's obviously not a viable business model. So habits are going to change coming out of this. Behaviors are going to change. And I think what we don't know yet is the degree to which we might be, for example, willing to socialize with our friends, with our family, maybe go out and be on a beach together. But are people really going to take that extra risk, which is at a certain level what it is, to go be on a mini golf course and to go be in an arcade and touching the arcade machine that so many other people might have touched in that same day? We just don't know yet.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. We've got Judith on the line from Milwaukee. Judith, hi.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I'm calling from Gallery 218 in Milwaukee. We're an artist-run gallery, and we are celebrating our 30th anniversary in July. We count a special event here called Gallery Night. It takes place four times a year. We really get good crowds, and like I said, we count on it. However, we had to cancel April's for obvious reasons, and now the next one is supposed to be in July. And, yeah, it's a big dilemma. Some galleries want to go ahead with it and try to accommodate with masks and so forth, and others are too afraid and don't want to do it. So it's a hard decision to make.
Judith, thank you so much for sharing that experience. An example, David, of a community event that a lot of local artists in this case or other business people might rely on. The last one canceled, the next one, as Judith said, still up in the air.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be so interesting to see what kind of precautions people do take, and as we're seeing, how consumers, how the public responds. You know, if people say masks are mandatory for, say, an art gallery opening, what happens when that first person who doesn't want to play by the rules shows up? Does the energy turn sour? Does it spoil the night for some people? These are the things everyone's going to have to work out. Now, you mentioned these small communities, and that's important, but big cities rely on this economy in real fundamental ways, too. You just think about your convention center in Milwaukee, some of your beautiful art museums there. These are big institutions that drive a big, important parts of the local economy there. And I just don't know. You know, we're going to see when the next air show happens, right? Are people going to show up for the big air shows? Are people going to show up for the big boat shows in Miami? It's still a big question as to whether that's going to happen. And if they don't, what is going to be lost? Not just economically, but again, I think we need to think about the meaning, about the opportunity for promotion. You know, those bands at South by Southwest, they're not breaking through this summer because they didn't have their breakout moments where bands usually come out.
We're talking to David Gelis, business reporter with the New York Times. We're talking about what coronavirus has meant for the business of gathering people with things like conferences, tourist locations, music festivals, and so much more, and how those experiences may change as the country starts to reopen. You can join in at 800-642-1234. When you think you might be ready to go to a concert again or perform at a concert again if you're on that side of the stage. How about something smaller scale, a bar or a restaurant or a water park or a gallery night? If you are someone who usually loves these kind of gatherings, what do you miss the most? What's it going to take to get you going to them again? If you rely on this for your livelihood, love to hear from you as well. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about the experience economy, the business of things like music, concerts, axe-throwing bars, convention centers, sports, and how it's changed with the coronavirus outbreak. David Gelis is with us. He writes the Corner Office column for the New York Times. He covered this issue there. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What would you need to feel comfortable going to see live music or a baseball game at a stadium? Are you ready to go back and do it right now, or do you need time to see how those events could happen safely? How has your life changed not being able to experience things like birthdays or anniversaries out at a special place? If you rely on a business like this for your own livelihood, let us know how things are going for you, how you are trying to adjust to the current reality. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. David, there's been talk of, okay, restaurants could open, but with, you know, limited capacity, quarter or a half. I've seen people putting mannequins in the empty tables, things like that. Is that going to be a viable business model, packing your business, whatever it might be, to such a limited capacity?
Well, I don't know a lot of businesses that can automatically survive with a half or a quarter of the revenues that they were accustomed to. So that alone is an obvious challenge. But there's also this more sustained question out there, which is, listen, I think a lot of people have found a way to bridge these first few months, and some of the relief efforts by the federal government have come through and given people, again, a way to maybe make it through to the summer. But what happens, again, if these events don't come back, especially the big ones, not just for another few weeks or maybe even not just for a few months, but I mean, we're talking, this could be into next year. It could be deep into next year before you can get 80,000 people together in a stadium, or before you can put, thousands or tens of thousands of people on these big cruise ships in a way that we know is going to be safe. So there's a much more sustained reckoning, I think, that's going to happen as some of the businesses and tragically, workers and employees who have really relied on the experience economy for their incomes face a future that remains sort of deeply uncertain.
And you've touched on this a couple times, kind of the personal side of this. If we don't have these spaces for, you know, that place we like to go, whatever it might be, with the people we love, what are we missing there?
And this is deeply personal. And I'm sitting here and I think about some of the most profound and joyful memories in my own life. And so many of them involve being in crowds. It might be with my loved ones, it might be with my best friends, but we were out somewhere. We were doing something. We were seeing a concert at the Greek Theater in Berkeley, California. We were at a music festival in Central Park. You know, these are fundamental things. I'm here at my father-in-law's place right now because we're all displaced, and we go to football games every year, and that's just not going to happen. So this memory building, the way in which we form our identities, our relationships, so much of that, and this is, I think, what's so painful and hard for people, it's just not happening right now. And I think that even, you know, you can't minimize the economic toll because that is foremost and that's fundamental and that's disrupting people's lives in profound and sometimes irreparable ways. But there is this deeper sort of psychic level at which we're all missing something too. And that's very hard whether you have a job or not.
Let's bring on another caller now. Syed in Madison is with us. Syed, hi.
Thank you. Hi. Thanks for giving me an opportunity. I will just want to say one small comment. It's really important for me and for my family. I used to watch live games and go out and have social gathering. But psychologically, I think so. I'm at a position where I cannot take any risk. And I will still want to do social gathering. So what I'm start using it, I start asking my friends to come over, keep a safe distance, have a drink, have food, watch game together, or just catch up with each other. So moving forward, I think so this year, instead of going to Packer games, we might stay home and watch stuff. That's how I feel.
Syed, thanks a lot for the call. Syed taking baby steps from his home. It sounds like it could be a long way there for people like him, David, to get to the point where they're ready to go to, say, Lambeau Field again for the game.
It doesn't surprise me, and I think since we're talking about sports and talking about professional sports, it's going to be fascinating to see what these first games or first, you know, months of these seasons will be like. I was writing the story when the UFC, the Ultimate Fighting Championship, I think, had their first televised event a couple weeks ago. So I tuned in. Count me sort of a casual fan, but I wanted to see what it was like because they were doing this with no fans in the stands. And listen, the event went on. And one of the sort of macabre side effects of there not being any fans there was you could hear every hit, you could hear every punch and kick much more distinctly than you might otherwise. And listen, that's going to be the same, is going to be true in football and baseball and basketball and hockey. If these all move to fanless games, we're going to hear things, we're going to see things that we didn't previously. That's going to be interesting, but I think a lot of us, like Syed, are still going to wish we would be in the stands with a beer and a hot dog in our hands.
David, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was David Gelis with the Corner Office column at the New York Times. He was with us today to talk about how the coronavirus pandemic is impacting the experience economy and what that sector might look like as states start to reopen. You can keep sharing your thoughts and experiences over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up Monday on Central Time, two Wisconsin lawmakers want to create a ranked choice voting system here in the state. We'll find out what that means and how it could work here in Wisconsin. Historian and author Ken Davis is back with us to share the history of Memorial Day and how it's been observed in different ways over the years. And Wisconsin researchers share some of the latest dinosaur news with recent discoveries that suggest that Jurassic Park may have gotten some things kind of wrong. All that and a look at some of the biggest news of the day in Wisconsin and around the country. It's coming up Monday here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Monday at 6, Wisconsin is seeing record levels of unemployment, and there are concerns about protecting workers' health as businesses reopen. A labor attorney joins the show. That's Monday at 6 on the morning show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then a lot of us may be getting out the grills, maybe for the first time over this weekend. We'll talk to barbecue expert Meathead about how to make sure our grill is in working order and how to make the food as delicious as we can. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.